the sort of media coverage about these disasters, they're covered as one-offs, as isolated incidents, that here's this devastating fire, you know, we were praying for you, you'll survive, look at the community spirit. I don't want to have to just survive. I don't want to have to rely on community spirit and my neighbors and GoFundMes to figure out, you know, where I'm going to be living next. I want my tax dollars to go towards taking care of me, my community, and all of us being together. So we need a cultural shift in our country, away from thinking individualistically about the biggest car we can drive and the ways in which we can protect ourselves, without thinking about how we protect our community and how we're all in this together. So we have to fight for control over our budgets. We have to fight for control over the priorities that we make, pouring them into climate resiliency and adaptation, and ending the stranglehold of fossil fuels over our country and our world. We have to change that cultural mindset, and we have to push our politicians to do the right thing. And billionaires should not exist.
We have to leave it there right now, but we will certainly continue to cover all these issues. Sonali, it is hard to wish you a happy birthday, but on your landmark birthday, we're thinking of you. Sonali Kahatkar, evacuated host of Rising Up with Sonali, and also John Valiant, the author of Fire Weather. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, thousands of Oregon healthcare workers get ready to strike starting at 6 tomorrow morning, including, for the first time, doctors. Local Red Cross workers are joining the front lines of the fight against the devastating LA wildfires. And a new Oregon Democratic Congresswoman makes her first speech on the U.S. House floor. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 9th, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. Portland area hospitals are getting ready to shuffle patients, expecting a Providence strike to strain resources and disrupt healthcare services for thousands of patients throughout Oregon. About 5,000 frontline healthcare workers, including doctors and nurses, are planning to walk off their jobs starting at 6 a.m. They include workers at Providence's 8 hospitals and 6 clinics. This could be the largest healthcare worker strike ever in the state. This afternoon, members of the Oregon Nurses Association spoke out.
My name is Ann Tam Piazza. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Nurses Association. We represent 21,000 health professionals in the state. We are less than 18 hours away from the largest healthcare strike in Oregon history and the first doctor strike in Oregon. It is truly an historic event. The nearly 5,000 Providence frontline workers who are taking this action are fired up, they're ready to go, they're committed, and they're angry, because Providence has systematically lowered the standards of care and focused on a healthcare model that prioritizes profits over our patients. That is not why ONA members started their career in healthcare. Our caregivers perform countless hours of physically and mentally exhausting work caring for the most vulnerable people here in Oregon. And our members are fed up. Some have been at the bargaining table for more than 15 months and working without contract for now more than a year. All we're asking for is Providence to be able to focus more on patient care and less time driving up profits. We want safe staffing guarantees in our contracts. We want smaller caseloads so our caregivers have more time with our patients. We want competitive wages and benefits so our caregivers can recruit and retain. We want Providence to stop cutting their healthcare benefits. And we want Providence to stop bargaining in bad faith and stop committing more unfair labor practices. We're not asking for much, but what we are asking for will improve healthcare for all Providence patients. Unfortunately, Providence executives have not stepped up for their frontline caregivers. Striking is not something we want to do, but something that is necessary, because the status quo at Providence is just not acceptable anymore. This strike could have been avoided. And frankly, there is still time, even at this 11th hour. We need Providence to stop refusing to negotiate and come back to the table. Let's reach a fair contract for all of our members, and let's stop the strike before it starts. It really is that simple. Our frontline caregivers are vital to patient care. They're the ones who make healthcare happen, and they have seen the decline in patient care standards that's been coming down from Providence executives. On Monday, December 30th, we sent Providence our 10 days notice of intent to strike to allow Providence time to prepare for the strike. This notice is required by law, and at that point, Providence refused to bargain with us with the excuse that they needed time to prepare for the strike. But since then, they have made claims that some services will be disrupted and some facilities will be shuttered. They should be at the table bargaining with us right now.
My name is Gina Ottinger, and I've had the privilege of working as a night shift nurse at Providence St. Vincent Emergency Department for the past 14 years. I'm here today not just as a nurse, but as someone who is deeply invested in the health and future of nursing at St. Vincent for our patients and the dedicated staff who provide care every single day. We are now entering our 17th month of contract negotiations. The issue at hand is not just about pay. It's about the future of nursing at our hospital and the quality of care we can provide to our community. St. Vincent's Hospital has been a foundation of care for this community for years, and we've all worked incredibly hard to ensure it continues to be. But right now, we're at a crossroads. Providence Management has refused to offer a fair contract. They've not recognized how more complex patient care has become, and they have not acknowledged how much sicker patients are now. Their resistance to listening to those of us who are on the front lines is putting every essence of healthcare, of the healthcare system, at risk. The strike is about far more than just wages. It's about staffing, employee healthcare, patient care, and overall working conditions. But first, I want to talk to you about wages. We're asking for competitive compensation that reflects the reality of our work, the long hours, the emotional toll, and the ever-growing demands placed on us. We're asking for wages that keep pace with inflation, they are on par with other hospitals in our region, and that recognize our commitment to the organization, because nurses and other frontline caregivers are leaving for better wages, better benefits, and better working conditions in neighboring hospital systems. If Providence wants to retain the experienced talent we work so hard to recruit and train, we must offer competitive wages that show we value their work. Nurses are the backbone of patient care, and safe staffing is critical. Right now, the hospital has not agreed to a proposal that considers acuity and intensity in determining nurse-to-patient ratio. Every patient is different, and the complexity of care that is required varies from patient to patient. Yet we are often asked to care for more patients than is safe or reasonable. When we have too many patients, patient safety is at risk, and then nurse well-being is at risk, which then puts one's license at risk. We need enough nurses to respond to patients' needs in real time, ensuring that we can deliver the level of care that our patients expect and deserve. This isn't just a matter of numbers on a page. It's about patient outcomes, nurse well-being, and staff retention. We're not asking for the impossible. We are asking for what is fair. Fair wages that reflect the skill and dedication required of us, fair staffing levels that allow us to do our jobs safely and effectively. And without these critical components, we will continue to see experienced nurses leave. And when they leave, so does the institutional knowledge and the patient trust that we've built over years of hard work. We want to stay. We want to continue serving our communities with the excellence we've always strived for.
My name is Richard Botterill. I'm an emergency room nurse at Providence Portland, where I'm also privileged to be chair of the bargaining team. And I'm also a member of the ONA Board of Directors. I scrapped the words I was going to use today about how what we are doing today is only possible because of the work that has gone before us, the nurses who have gone before us within the union, and how what we are doing today is driven by our commitment to improving the quality of healthcare for our patients and the communities that we serve, and how what we are doing today is to strengthen the foundation for the nurses that will follow us to provide quality care for our children and our children's children, and as a grandfather, our children's children. I was going to talk about what makes the actions we are taking today different than before, because nurses at all 8 Providence hospitals and the Providence Women's Clinic are working together to stand up to a company that places profits before patients, rather than patients before profits. It is different today because we are joined by the physicians and practitioners many of us work with as a team who are taking action for the same reasons, the reasons you've just heard Gina talk about. Then I started to read comments from my sister and brother nurses around Providence, and it was clear that their words convey better than mine the reasons for taking the actions we are taking today. From a nurse who has worked for Providence for 24 years, I wanted to work for a company with values. It had values in 2000. It no longer lives its mission. I got a $1,000 bonus the first year I was a nurse. That was every year. Now the CEO and the C-suite get the bonuses, and we get nothing. We used to pay $10 copays and $500 deductible. My deductible for my family is $6,300. We used to have a pension, that is gone. We used to have sick time and vacation, not paid time off. When you got sick, you had sick time, not your vacation or unpaid. We were respected. We have lost so much, they will continue to whittle all our benefits away until we have nothing. And this from a nurse who started in 2001. I was always happy to come to work and felt like I worked for the best hospital system in the state. Our patients raved about the care they received, and we knew it was superior. How have we fallen so hard? This strike needs to happen, or every single contract expiration will look like this in the future.
Oregon's firefighters aren't the only ones heading to California to aid in the wildfires. Red Cross workers from Oregon and Southwest Washington headed out this afternoon, too. Last night, Red Cross shelters in Southern California cared for more than 1,000 people looking for food, information, health, and health care and emotional support. Firefighters arrived to help battle the 5 wildfires earlier today. The Red Cross also helps people find a shelter during the disaster and can help people find their loved ones. More than 100,000 people are under evacuation orders in the Los Angeles area. Those who are not evacuating are dealing with bad air quality and, in some cases, water that isn't safe to drink. The fires started in a combination of dry fuels, hurricane-force winds, and low humidity. Fire weather conditions are forecasted to continue into Friday, meaning containment of the fires is still at least days away. And at the scene of the historic fires tearing through Southern California, President Biden joined Governor Gavin Newsom, who expressed his gratitude for the president's help.
It's impossible for me to express the level of appreciation and cooperation we received from the White House and this administration. So on behalf of all of us, Mr. President, thank you for being here, but not just being here today, thank you for being here since the minute incident.
All of Oregon's counties except one are considered child care deserts for infants and toddlers, and every county has a child care shortage for young children. Isabel Charlet has more in the story.
Nearly 9,000 families are on the wait list for the Oregon Employment-Related Daycare Program, and family advocates are calling on lawmakers to ramp up funding to meet the growing need. Child care prices in Oregon can exceed college tuition and have outpaced growth in household incomes, according to research by Oregon State University. Dana Hepper with the Children's Institute says most families, even if they don't qualify for the ERDC, cannot afford child care.
And most child care providers do not make living wages. So we can't rely on just parents paying tuition to solve this childcare crisis.
Hepper says the state needs to spend at least $500 million more on the ERDC program this year. This would serve the families that are on the wait list, as well as those who have vouchers for the program but cannot find a childcare provider. All but one county in Oregon is considered a childcare desert for infants and toddlers, according to Hepper. A childcare desert is defined as having only one licensed childcare slot for every three or more children. She adds that there has been more funding for preschools, such as Head Start and Multnomah County's Preschool for All, which has expanded access. But even if they are not deserts, Hepper adds, every county in the state has a shortage of preschool care.
I think there's a dearth of childcare because there's a lack of public investment in childcare, and the data bears that out.
Hepper highlights Gillam County as the only Oregon county that's not a desert for infant childcare because it has invested public funds. She adds that the ERDC program alone will not solve the childcare crisis. The state also suffers from a shortage of childcare workers.
We need strategies that support the workforce and invest in pathways to enter this workforce with the skill that you need.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
There are some downsides to the holiday season, including a high chance of getting sick. KBOO's Josh Salem updates us on seasonal viral respiratory illnesses.
Respiratory illnesses are hitting Americans with a vengeance. People tend to travel and get together with family and friends over the holidays, and this can increase exposure to a variety of bugs. Influenza, or the flu, in particular, is at high or very high levels all around the country, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Also, respiratory syncytial virus and COVID-19 rates are rising. While the COVID situation is no longer considered to be an emergency, the virus still causes more hospitalizations and deaths than flu or RSV. Adding it to the mix means every respiratory season, on average, is going to be worse than what we saw 5 years ago. No one can predict how bad things can get this winter. But the good news is, the CDC says that unless some more highly transmissible new COVID-19 variant emerges, it still looks like this winter will be similar to last. The peaks of those three viruses hit at closely spaced times. That means as soon as one starts to calm down, another virus starts hitting its peak. No real break is expected at least through January. Even then, there could be a long tail. Winter RSV often peaks in December or January, but it is still around through spring. People could keep getting sick for several more weeks, if not months. Experts recommend that people wash their hands frequently, wear masks in crowded places, and get vaccinated. The flu and COVID shots do not offer 100% protection against illness, but they do decrease the chance of hospitalization and the risk of dying, especially for older people and others who are vulnerable. Unfortunately, most Americans still haven't gotten either of those shots, but it's not too late to consider vaccination. Also, new tests, which let people check at home for the flu and COVID, are available for the first time this year. They could help their doctors decide more quickly whether or not they need antiviral drugs. The big three are not the only threats. Mycoplasma, which can cause walking pneumonia, and whooping cough are still spreading widely. Another respiratory virus has been getting some press recently. The human metapneumovirus has been surging in northern China, but the World Health Organization said the levels of the virus in China are not that unusual. No emergency declarations or responses have been triggered, and many people actually already have immunity. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon's new Democratic member of Congress in District 5, Janelle Bynum, made her first speech on the congressional floor today.
I rise today to tell the people of Oregon that I'm ready to deliver for them. As someone who has lived, operated businesses, and raised my four children in our community, I know that families are struggling and feel like their voice isn't heard. I'm here to say that I'm listening and I'm fighting for our families. My top priorities are making sure that our kids are learning, healthy, and thriving, supporting hardworking families who feel like their government has left them behind, and I'm working to bring new and good jobs back to Oregon, and I'll work with anyone to do it. It's important to me to have open communication with my constituents so they can always contact me and get updates from me by going to my website at bynum.house.gov. I thank you for trusting me.
In November, Bynum defeated first-term Republican Lori Chavez de Remer, who is now President-elect Trump's choice for transportation secretary. And you probably heard that Trump says Canada should become the USA's 51st state.
But Canadian politician Elizabeth May says the three West Coast states of Oregon, Washington, and California would be better off becoming part of the Great White North. She says they'd benefit from universal health care and stricter gun laws if they join Canada.
I don't want to belittle Mr. Trump, but on the other hand, hey, Donald, have we got a deal for you? You think we want to be the 51st state? Nah, but maybe California would like to be the 11th province. How about it? California, Oregon, Washington, you've got geography in common with us. And not only that, we've already got a carbon trading system between California and Quebec. We've got some strong alliances on our West Coast from British Columbia. There's been a lot of academic papers on the idea of Cascadia. So California, Governor Newsom, and Washington State, Jay Inslee, and newly elected Governor of Oregon, Tina Kotek, how about it? Want to put a referendum to your citizens? Because this is what you deal. Have we got a deal for you? This is what you get. Free health care. Universal free health care. No more one-year-olds who suddenly fall off the Medicaid list and their parents are in the news because they're trying to do a GoFundMe so they can get their daughter to a doctor. Universal free health care. And guess what? Those gun laws that your Congress is too afraid to pass because of the national gun lobby, we already got our strict gun laws. That's why we have the safest streets around the world. Or at least in the United States, by the way, the most recent stats, 5.9 out of every 100,000 people is killed in a fatal gun incident versus 0.88 per 100,000 in Canada. That's because we have strict gun laws. California citizens, Oregon, Washington, safer streets. Here we already have good gun laws, and women have a right to an abortion under our universal health care system. But, you know, we don't have to stop there. Donald, think about it. You could get rid of all these states that always vote Democrat. You know what else will take Bernie Sanders off your hands? Proud new Canadian citizen of the great province of Vermont. Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, we'd love to see you. Enough kidding around. But honestly, President Trump, get used to it. Canada is a sovereign nation full of, guess what? Proud Canadians. We're not jingoistic. We don't boast a lot. That's one of the things we kind of have in common with Jimmy Carter. We're not a big nation for braggarts and bullies. We actually like to think we're of service in the world. We could do better. We can always do better. But we love our country. And it's a country. It's a nation. And we do not aspire to be 51st state. So let's not hear that anymore.
That was Canada's Green Party leader, Elizabeth May. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy skies with some rain overnight, down to 38 for the low. Tomorrow's weather, mostly cloudy, occasional rain, a high near 50. Today in history, on this date in 2009, President Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to strengthen international cooperation. Our quote of the day is from Obama. If you're walking down the right path and you're willing to keep walking, eventually you'll make progress. A new report from the nonprofit Climate Center unearthed historical documents that show big oil companies orchestrated a tax break that allows them to avoid paying an estimated $75 to $146 million a year. Suzanne Potter has the story.
The state legislature adopted the so-called Water's Edge tax policy in 1986. Barry Vesser with the Climate Center says it allows companies to decide which of their earnings are taxable in California and exclude those linked to operations elsewhere, thus dramatically reducing what they owe in taxes.
The report shows companies like Chevron and Shell and Exxon back in the 70s and 80s worked really hard to get this exemption into the tax code, in spite of the fact that lots of advocates and many people in government were saying that this is a bad idea, including the head of the Franchise Tax Board at the time.
The report estimates that Water's Edge costs California about $4 billion a year across all industries. The oil companies argue that it is unfair for a state to tax their global earnings. However, oil-rich Alaska prohibits Water's Edge tax exemptions. Climate advocates are pressing California lawmakers to end all subsidies for these companies in budget negotiations this spring. Fesser notes that last year, California's budget cut billions from climate programs to help fill a $46 billion deficit. Meanwhile, Chevron, Shell, and Exxon reported $83 billion in profits in 2023.
Oil and gas companies spent $31.4 million in 2024. They broke a record, even in the first three quarters, of all-time spending at the California State Legislature. These companies are working to undermine sensible public policy outcomes.
Assemblymember Damon Connolly said in a statement that eliminating the water's edge tax break for multinational oil and gas corporations is a common-sense solution to make polluting industries pay their fair share to fix environmental and health problems they have helped create. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Today has been a national day of mourning for former President Jimmy Carter. President-elect Trump's proposals are getting pushback from officials and experts, and another Trump pick worries experts who cite a lack of experience. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's 2025 Talks.
I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
Today is a national day of mourning for former President Jimmy Carter. His body has been lying in state in the Capitol, and he'll be buried today next to his wife Rosalynn after a state funeral in Plains, Georgia. Though Carter's term was marred by an energy crisis, high inflation, and American hostages held in Iran, his later humanitarian work earned him a Nobel Peace Prize. Meanwhile, current Secretary of State Antony Blinken says President-elect Donald Trump's plan to take control of Greenland, a territory of NATO ally Denmark, won't happen. Trump says for economic and national security, he's willing to buy or use force to take the huge Arctic island close to Europe and Russia. Blinken says the U.S. already has trade and military bases there.
One of the basic propositions we brought to our work over the last 4 years is we're stronger, we're more effective, we get better results when we're working closely with our allies, not saying or doing things that may alienate them.
Reports say the people of Greenland have no interest in joining the U.S. Reactions in Canada, Panama, and Mexico suggest Trump's proposals to take back the canal, rename the Gulf of Mexico, and make Canada the 51st state are similarly unpopular. Trump has tapped first-term domestic policy aide Brooke Rollins to lead the Department of Agriculture. Rollins has been leading a MAGA think tank, the America First Policy Institute. But some worry she's inexperienced and say Trump's food policy picks seem contradictory. Emily Bass directs the agriculture program for the Breakthrough Institute.
I think folks are looking to see what her answers are during her confirmation hearing. When she's confirmed, I believe she will be, how her policy clash or align with RFK Jr.'s policy positions.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
Looking at stories in rural communities of the Northwest, a Washington state expert says drill baby drill is a tough sell for oil and gas companies in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And rising sea levels are creating struggles for Washington's coastal communities.
Oil and gas companies are set to once again submit bids to drill in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But thanks to then historically low oil prices, the Department of Interior's sale in 2021 didn't attract much interest. And University of Washington geologist Scott Montgomery says the extreme environment makes it expensive.
So the oil price has to be pretty high for people to feel the incentive to go up there.
In 1960, President Dwight D. Eisenhower set aside 9 million acres for wildlife, wilderness, and recreation. Environmentalists have opposed drilling in the ANWR for decades, citing accelerated climate change and what Montgomery calls a rich, unique, and fragile ecosystem.
It is a migration pathway and a habitation for a lot of birds, but also large caribou herds, muskox, and polar bear.
Alaskan natives have mixed feelings about the leases. Some raise environmental concerns, while others say the industry funds community infrastructure like schools and provides half of the region's jobs. Rising sea levels mean struggles for Washington's coastal communities. Anya Slepian has more.
North Cove, Washington, is known for nearly 800 acres of commercial cranberry bogs. But coastal flooding from climate change and dam building could wipe out the bogs and the communities that depend on them. Connie Allen is with local anti-erosion group Wash Away No More.
It could easily, within a few years, flood all the cranberry bogs you see out here.
Allen and her husband held community fundraisers to build a cobble berm to stop beach erosion. And soon, that work drew support from local and national grants. But coastline communities know the warming climate will be a continuous challenge.
Our storms are stormier, our winters are wetter. We have the same amount of rainfall, but it comes all at once.
I'm Anya Slepian.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
In the wake of November's election, people in Nevada and other battleground states are showing significant interest in running for state and local offices. Alex Gonzalez reports.
Over 12,000 people nationwide have shown interest in wanting to learn more about running for office since last year's election. The share coming from battleground states like Nevada has grown by about 50%. Jordan Haynes with the nonprofit Run for Something says his organization has noticed the majority of people entering their candidate pipeline post-election day have been women. He adds they're seeing interest in offices at the local and community-wide level, such as sheriff and school board positions.
Those are really important because they're going to be first line of defense against immigration policy, against setting a federal education department. And so I think hopeful for two reasons. One, building the bench, and two, building local power now.
While female representation on Capitol Hill diminished slightly compared to last year, Haynes says that isn't the case for states like Nevada. It's one of three states where more than half of its legislators are women, according to the Center for American Women in Politics. Haynes adds that it's too early to know what exactly motivated the more than 12,000 folks nationwide, but it's something his organization will keep an eye on. If you're interested in learning more about running for state or local office, you can visit runforwhat.net. Haynes says his organization will continue to get more people of diverse backgrounds and lived experiences to run for office. He says they not only help guide folks along the way, but they also help them determine the best office to run for. He says prep work is crucial.
The Run for Something alums they ran initially to try and solve some problem in their community. And so we are always looking for that, looking for like what really motivates people to get into the race, what office they're looking to run for, if that office has the power to solve the problem that they're trying to solve.
Haynes acknowledges that for many, November's election results were anything but ideal, but he says change takes time, and that's something he and others are working towards.
Have people in Congress who are Run for Something alumni. That is hope. That is like medium-term hope, right? It takes years and election cycles for that to happen.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 9th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings and Josh Salem, the producers Annette Newell, and our engineers Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website,